Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm J.D. Bunkus, Justin Cuthbert, Blake Murphy. How was your guys' 8:30 Raptors against the San Antonio Spurs? All of a sudden, the Spurs, can I tell you guys something? There's a weird thing between the Spurs and the Raptors now. Ever since the Kawhi DeMar trade, I felt like that game was sort of supposed to feel bigger than it actually did once it started. I'm used to those games mattering now because of the DeMar Kawhi trade. And yesterday was just one of those, oh, right, it's not as much stakes for Thad Young's return to the Spurs where he was playing 12 minutes a night.
You did get the yak hard foul on Siakam on the first offensive play of the game, though. And it's, man, you've changed. But yeah, there is like, there's a little bit of, I don't know if it's kinship between these two teams or what, but they have done three trades together now. They did the Nando DeColo Austin Day, the Kawhi trade, and now the Thad Young Goran Dragic trade.
Nando DeColo Austin Day, as we all remember from Blake Murphy writing about it every single year, tongue in cheek about them taking the.
There was a time where Masai and the Spurs both barely ever made trade deadline moves, and that was the one example of like, no, these teams will. You just got to make the right offer. You just have to have the right lanky 6'10" power forward to swap out for a restricted free agent.
I love that because my brain went three trades.
You knew.
And Austin DeColo, Blake Murphy. I wonder how many people would get that trivia in the entire city.
I don't know. Anyone who's been reading my stuff for the last decade would get it for sure.
But you know what? That's even the best part about you writing about that every single year and even being as big of a Raptors writer as you are, that still, no one in the city would get that correct. No one would end up answering that question.
But Bobby Webster, when he was on our show the day after the trade deadline, more or less said they're just keeping Nando DeColo's restricted free agent rights for me.
Yeah,
at this
true.
Point. He's not coming over.
It does seem that way. So Fred VanVleet returns last night. They play the Spurs. Yeah, there's also this thing with the Spurs that's probably offensive to Popovich if he cared, but he probably doesn't at this point. I think that Pop is just beyond that point in his career. But the Raptors got the Spurs East thing for a little while. You guys remember that? They tried to do the Raptors are, they're becoming a model franchise. They're just consistent year in, year out. And Tim Duncan, Manu Ginobili, and Tony Parker are watching going, that team? The team that won one time because they got our guy when he forced his way out of town? They're us now for some reason? Fine, sure, whatever. Call them the Eastern Conference us. But now there's the kind of David Thompson comes on here a lot and brings up how Coach Nurse is going to be the next Popovich. There's just those parallels, the organizational credibility of these two places. And so, I don't know why. I'm wonder if other Raptors fans feel that way. That's why I was kind of starting it and asking you guys, is this weird thing when you watch these two teams play that it almost feels like it should be bigger. I kind of, you know what I feel like a little bit? I feel like probably Canucks fans do when they play the Leafs, where you go, hey, this game matters. And Leaf fans go, to you, you know, like that's, we're the Canucks fans in this.
I think the honest answer is, JD, you're a big general NBA guy. It's that the Spurs are supposed to feel bigger than this. It's not really specific to the
Maybe
Raptors.
That's it.
It's the Spurs who, from 1997 to 2019, won five championships and did not miss the playoffs.
Yeah.
Like they were. And maybe they weren't appointment viewing all the time because they kind of pioneered the we're going to rest guys. But, like, they had the bit of beautiful game basketball going on. A lot of the they're the model franchise. You take this, this, and this from them across sports and learn these lessons. And, again, the five titles with the same core 15 years apart. I don't know. The Spurs are supposed to be bigger in basketball. And them having three straight losing years, like this last year was the first time they'd ever missed the playoffs 2 years in a row. And now this will be a third. It's just, I don't think it's specific to the Raptors. I think the Spurs are just supposed to matter more than this. And Greg, like the main storyline being, can Popovich in a year, it's probably the least enjoyable year he's ever had, break the record for all-time wins by way of longevity? And it's like, I'm sure Popovich would rather have had one more good playoff season than go through another 30-win year.
So last night, that was my one thought. Second thought, And we'll get to Fred and get to actually some of the real meaningful ones. This is a little fun. DeJounte Murray is really fun to watch. I really enjoy watching him play. His body control now, he's reached a bit of a different level as a player this year specifically. I mean, that's no surprise to anyone. He became an all-star this season. But he's finally putting all the pieces together. And he was a guy that I was always really high on. And if you look at it, if you look at his, or if you remember his background, so to say, he was in the same draft as Pascal Siakam. And if you remember the Siakam pick, a lot of people had a problem with it at the time because they passed on a kid that fell in the draft in Scal Labissiere from Kentucky. And also DeJounte Murray, who was a projected lottery pick. Murray was someone who, leading up to the draft, was supposed to be someone who went anywhere between 8 and 14. And he fell further than just about anyone in that year's draft class. I remember this a little bit more because I root for Washington. That's my college basketball team that I like. And he fell. And I remember thinking at the time, please draft DeJounte Murray. They took Siakam, and I was a little disappointed. I went, oh, they went with the project. Okay, fine. Turned out to be the right pick, obviously. Siakam ends up potentially being the best pick in the entire draft class. I did think, though, today, would you trade Siakam for Murray? 2 years younger, DeJounte Murray, and just given what the Raptors need, right, which is another ball handler, someone who can create their own shot, score for themselves, create for others. He's also a high-end defensive player, so you can't remove the defense, because there's actually an argument that DeJounte Murray's like one of the best, if not, what would you say he is right now, Blake, in terms of like lockdown guys at his position? He leads the NBA in steals, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah,
and I know that's a Gary Trent Jr. stat, but his is actually an on-ball statistic.
If they were winning games, he'd be probably second-team all-defense at a guard position. I don't think he's going to get it because they just haven't been good and the team defensive environment isn't strong enough. But, yeah, he's really, really good defensively.
Just out of curiosity, I'm like, who do you think has more trade value today, Siakam or Murray? Murray's 2 years younger, by the way.
He's also cheaper.
Yeah,
by a significant amount. He's owed $16.5 million next year and $17.7 million the year after that because he did that Norm Powell kind of level extension before he hit free agency. So I would think Murray has a little more value by way of age and contract. I think it's a scenario where it's probably one of those both teams say no. Like both teams ask for a little bit more. And then as with everything, right, like there's the question of, with Murray, and maybe you don't get Fred VanVleet if you draft DeJounte Murray, but does he develop the same under Lowry? All those questions come up, but he's very good.
It's one of those. Okay, so I love that draft class because it's a hilarious. You move the pieces if you did a redraft. It's just a fun draft to look back on and always wonder where Siakam goes, because for a while it was, well, Jaylen Brown, would he be number one? Where does Brandon Ingram stack up right now in terms of value? He's having a pretty fantastic season, but I don't think that... I think he is kind of what he is. Ben Simmons, obviously, I don't think goes first overall anymore, but there's still a case. Like, you could end up seeing Ben Simmons play with the Nets down the home stretch here, and I think you could end up having him back in that number one spot. Jamal Murray could come back, look incredible. I think it's going to be a next year thing, but... Yeah, then you have Pascal Siakam and DeJounte Murray, who were later in that draft. It's a
and
fun
Fred
one.
And Fred, who went undrafted.
Yeah, Fred, who went undrafted. That's true. Well, if Fred is actually in the draft, he's definitely going in the, what, top?
He's a top 10 pick in a redraft. Like, he's an all-star.
He's a top 10 pick. I wonder where he goes exactly. Like, you wouldn't take Fred over Ben Simmons, as much as that hurts me to say, because I actually would rather have Fred than Ben Simmons. You know, like, if the Nets called tomorrow and said, would you do this? From a point of principle, I would say absolutely not, even though the move would be a higher upside move. Like, if I'm the general manager, I'm going, you think you want me to trade the guy who's tough and loves basketball for the guy who is willing to sit out the entire NBA season because he won't shoot any shots? No. But yeah, Ingram, Jaylen Brown, and then Jamal Murray. I wonder where you put our old injury-prone guy, Caris LeVert. He's probably in the top 10 as well. And then those two.
Yeah, so Fred, by the way, win shares isn't a great like short sample stat, but just to kind of pile up the performance, he's fifth in that draft class in win shares.
But that's good over a long sample, right? For
yeah, exactly.
Where their careers are at? Yeah, fifth?
Yeah, and you get a little bit of, well, Fred barely played as a rookie, so how does that stack up? Jakob Poeltl actually has – he grades out really well by some of the advanced stuff with where he's gotten. But, yeah, I think Fred – I think basically you got three top 10 picks if you're the Raptors at 9-27 and undrafted. Obviously, you traded Poeltl since, but pretty good work that 2016.
So – I really wanted Sabonis over Poeltl because I'm a smart draft guy. They went with Poeltl instead. But I also actually wanted Henry Ellenson more than any of them. So I'm
Big Hank.
Yeah.
Just, hey, you got him eventually.
I did.
You
yeah.
got a 10-day.
Trust me. I actually am one of the only Raptors people who remembers, because that entire draft year I wanted Henry Ellenson. He was the guy that I went, this guy's the next Kevin Love, and he'd be a perfect fit for the Raptors. Go out and get Henry Ellenson. Remember, they needed a power forward desperately at the time. That was the thing. They needed a power forward. And when they took Jakob Poeltl, everyone went, really? You took another center when you have JV right now? You took a backup center? Okay. It was a pretty I remember wanting Henry Ellenson or DeMontis Sabonis, but Ellenson was the guy that I actually had targeted for most of the year. So I think I did like 3 podcasts on Henry Ellenson and how high I was on him.
You're not alone, though. Like, I really like Deontay Davis. And actually, when I do pre-draft stuff now,
yeah, that's a
like
good
I
one
mentioned
too.
The Deontay yeah. Davis
Deontay
corollary.
Davis. Yeah. Hey, high motor. High motor.
Well, this is the thing, though, is like the black box of the draft process for media is like you don't get to know these guys. You don't get to interview them. You can hit up someone from the team or someone who covered them, but those people are going to want to say positive things about them. Deontay Davis is a big, like, why is this guy sliding? And if there's no answer to it, you might have your answer to it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the way I approach the guys who slide now is like injury red flags get leaked.
Yeah.
Off court red flags don't necessarily get leaked.
Well, I also liked Ellenson because I've always been someone who believes that when Marquette has a good player, you take them.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll never forget being very bullish on Jimmy Butler and watching him slide in the draft and thinking, what the hell? Why did this guy fall so far? And Jimmy Butler has this incredible story, too, right? It's kind of lost in the fold of what a tough life he had and what a leader he was for his family. Like, and yeah, I just remember him falling to the Bulls and going, that's too far. He fell way, way, way too far. I got a weird, sneaky affinity for Marquette. Anyways, all this is probably boring a lot of people. So let's move on to the thing. Fred returns. Blake Murphy, what were your thoughts last night watching the Raptors game?
Yeah, the two big ones that I took away from this one were, the first one's Fred looked great. Fred looked, I think he had 21 of his 26 in the first half. He's pulling up from deep. He's working the pick and roll. You see right away where, like, he snaps into place and life gets easier for everyone else. I don't know. You know, it wasn't the best game of his career or anything like that, but he looked like a guy who hasn't played for about a month and feels a little fresher. So that's great. I think Fred being back knocks everyone down into a more natural and suitable spot in terms of shot creation responsibility. Obviously, he's a defensive presence as well. He comes up with 2 steals, kind of fuels the transition game. And the Raptors are, you know, he's right back to doing the Lowry impression where they're plus 19 in his 34 minutes and they lose the couple minutes he sits on the bench. So that was the first one. That's to be expected. But if you had any worry about Van Vliet's knee, I think you're okay after that game. The other one, I thought the second half was another really, really good Scottie Barnes performance from a self-creation standpoint. He finishes the game with 20 points, 8 rebounds, only 1 assist, and no turnovers. So maybe there isn't the same level of risk-taking and creativity as a passer. But he showed a lot in terms of, okay, this play has stopped. I'm going to have to ISO against a good defender, and I'm going to be able to get to the rim, or I'm going to be able to get to my spot for one of my funky little bank push shots. He's 8 of 12 shooting and gets to the line a couple times. We talked about, you know, in the game since the All-Star break, like, yes, there was that one game where he got 28 points on garbage buckets, basically.
Yeah.
But this is a guy who, since the All-Star break, has been creating a lot of his own offense, not having Fred and Pascal create that for him. And he did that last night. And yeah, it wasn't a tight game, and the Spurs aren't the best, but they have a couple, like Murray and Vassell are really good defenders. Keldon Johnson's a decent defender. And he kind of got what he wanted against those guys in the third and fourth quarter of what, until the very end, was a pretty tight game. So impressive Scottie Barnes second half.
I loved Scottie Barnes' game last night. I thought it was terrific. It was by far the best, most enjoyable part of watching the games. And I will admit that given what the Raptors' ceiling as a team appears to be this year now, I'm back on just caring really about Scottie Barnes. I just am. That's where I'm back. That's what's giving me joy watching Raptors games. Fred came back, Blake. I think that's, you know, the right thing. He didn't show any signs of rust. We have seen that from Fred in the past when he comes back from injury. It was pretty clear that they took the appropriate amount of time to make sure that his legs were underneath him. He looked fresh. He looked good. He knocked down shots. You knew it right away, that one shot he hits over Poeltl where Poeltl doesn't put his hand up and he's like 4 feet behind the three-point line. I went, oh, that's good. He's got his legs because he's that far behind the three-point line. He's happy to shoot it, and it drains. That's good. That's a great sign. He attacked the rim relentlessly, too. He even did some of the frustrating Fred VanVleet things where he went, right, man, I know it's like, what was the Stroman saying? Heart don't measure...
Height doesn't measure heart.
But it does measure getting, you know, the absolute crap blocked out of you at the rim sometimes. Like, there's, when you're that height, there are some really hilarious blocks that just end up coming your way.
There's that old fabulous lyric of money can't buy happiness, but it's a damn good down payment. Yeah, I feel like we need a height doesn't measure heart addendum like that.
Although Precious
doesn't, but it's a pretty good scale. Yeah.
No one got blocked harder than Precious last night, you know, and he's 6'9". But Scottie Barnes does this thing that I love, and I don't understand almost exactly quite how it's so effective, because so he did it again where he does clear outs. He asks for clear outs on the right side of the floor, and he will just turn his back to his opponent, and he'll be like what your older brother will do to you if he plays you in a basketball game, which is just backs you down from the three-point line. It's almost – it's comical. There's not too – there's I can't think of another guy in the NBA that does this. He just turns his back in ISO, and they have four on the other side, and he backs down, and he basically challenges the help to come, and then he gets within, what, 6 feet of the basket – and he turns and he push shots it in. And it's ugly. It's tremendously ugly. There's nothing sexy about it. But it's effective. It's really effective. And I kind of want the sports synergy or whatever stat for Scottie Barnes clear out on slightly smaller guy and just backs them down to get to his spot and scores that little push shot. It's weirdly like the Raptors' most effective offense. Like, if your life was on the line and you said, what Raptors play would you want? I wouldn't want OG Anunoby doing his, I'm going to dribble this until I get within 4 feet, and then I'm going to kind of stumble this thing, and sometimes I'm going to get it and put it through, and sometimes not. I wouldn't want the Siakam dribbling to the basket and then kind of fading away and going, ah! As he throws the ball up in the air. I wouldn't want the Fred VanVleet three-point shot from, you know, 4 feet behind the three-point line. I would want the Scottie Barnes clear out, turn the back somebody down, push shot. That's what I would want. That's my end game play.
See, that was my thing with Scottie Barnes, is I didn't really understand immediately how he was going to score with regularity. And I don't know if this is how he's going to score with regularity in the NBA, but this has become like the most efficient thing, oddly, and despite it looking pretty ugly at times. But I wonder where you guys see the progression of Barnes from the start of the year, because, you know, we obviously saw a tremendous third quarter from him, and that niche, that small niche where he's just bringing back old school post play to score efficiently when he has possession of the ball. So I like, obviously that's the story of the season, what Scottie Barnes makes of this rookie season and what he develops into. But I'm wondering just contextually, like, how that has evolved, because I wasn't watching every Scottie Barnes minute at the start of the year, watched a lot now, and I'm sort of surprised at how old school it feels.
Does feel a little old school, and he does have, you know, he's listed at 6'7". I think he's probably closer to 6'9". He's obviously, you know, he's pretty well built through the shoulders and stuff, and he's actually
a truck. He's an absolute truck.
But and like, he doesn't have the big lower half yet, where I think he's going to get even stronger with the whole offseason in an NBA strength and conditioning program. So yeah, there's a little bit of old school to it. I think one thing that'll he's shown really nice flashes of it. The next thing's going to be, hey, when you do those post-ups, you can't get the tunnel vision with it, right? Like, you got to be looking for ways to pass out of that and cutters. And he has good instincts with that. But the counter to those is going to be, it's like, remember when teams figured out Siakam's spin, guys would sit on it. If they figure out that that's Scotty Barnes' move, they're going to be ready to send a double over. And or even just like they'll do the Raptors thing where it's not even a double, but like you time the dribble and you pinch in right at the time of dribble, and he'll have to be aware of that. But he's such a natural sharer of the ball that I think that'll come along as well. So in terms of growth, Cuthbert, like he had this hot start where I think he caught a lot of defenses by surprise with the fact that he had the mid-range bag, he had the ability to get his own shot a little bit. Where I see the growth though is A, defenses started to figure him out, and he's now learning to counter that, and he's learning how to get other opportunities. And then the big one for me is like just how often he's able to create for himself. So among forwards, he's actually in the 94th percentile in terms of how many of your buckets are self-created.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, look, assists are great. You want the ball flowing around in an offense, but when it comes down to it, what can star-level guys do? And it's take a grimy possession, take a sticky possession, and get a bucket when the offense itself fails. And I think that's the area I've seen the most growth from him, which is great because it's the most important area in determining any player's offensive ceiling.
100%. And he's such an interesting player to evaluate because I would actually say that his defense is far less impressive than I thought it was going to be when he came into the NBA. I thought that he was going
to
come
in... Tough to be a rookie.
Yeah, it is tough to be a rookie, but I really did think that he was going to come in and have, like, this guy's already an NBA shutdown caliber type of season.
You thought he was going to have an OG rookie year, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't think he was going to be one of, you know, all NBA defense or anything. Like, he's not going to be what I guess maybe what I didn't expect from Evan Mobley to be that good right away. But I thought he was going to be like an Evan Mobley type where you went, oh my God, this guy's ceiling is one of the best defensive players in the NBA. That's where we're at with this guy. And night in, night out, I would say my biggest points of frustration with Scotty Barnes usually come in, sometimes he plays so fast on offense that you go, man, that's even if the ball goes in the net, which sometimes it does, right? Where he'll just, like, actually that play against Mobley comes to mind where he takes, he was against Mobley? I'm trying to think. He had a moment where, who was the game? What was the game where he got into it with that player, Blake? And I texted you. I was like, oh, look out for this. He's getting into it with somebody. And then.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't him. It was.
No, I think it wasn't
Mo. The Detroit game.
Either way, there's a moment where he gets into it with a player, and then the following possession, he just takes the ball, and it's like he's at a pickup game, and he goes, I'm going to try to score now, and it's this unbelievably fast-paced, you know, chuck shot that goes in, and you go, oh, well, the result was all right, but the process was awful. There are moments like that, but the defense is not exactly where I thought it would be. There's a lot of lapses. There's a lot of times where guys just frankly blow by him, and you kind of look back at it and say, what was the thought process here? Where was your mind at? What was happening? Again, tough to be a rookie. His game and his offense is ugly. It's ugly, ugly offense. He sort of does it in a way that you don't expect him to score with the efficiency that Blake's talking about. And so I always have this little bit of an underlying feeling of how much of the shot comes back to earth. Is there a potential that we're seeing a shooting percentage that's a little high on some shots that are that ugly and don't seem to have like consistent release points on some of these push shots, right? But they go in, and he seemingly just has a really nice touch. And sometimes guys just have touch, and I think Scotty Barnes has that when he gets within 10 feet of the basket, he's got touch to get the ball in there. He does have the little fadeaway thing that is way nicer than we ever anticipated it being, and it is a really nice piece to the arsenal because he's so tall and he's so long that he can shoot over top of most people. So that's going to be probably the most important part of the offensive package. But that bully ball thing that we mentioned is like, and OG has done it in the past too because he's a physical freak, but he doesn't have the ball handling that Scotty Barnes has. Scotty Barnes can get the ball with his handle to spaces that he is unbelievably efficient at. And so I don't know what the adjustment is other than what Blake said, which is, all right, I guess that the best defenders in the NBA can time dribbles a little bit better, but it seems like it's going to be a help situation. And if it's a help situation, he's supposed to be a playmaker that's good enough to be able to identify it and move the ball out of that, and that's probably where he's going to continue to grow. So thinking about what Scotty Barnes could be, last night is just a great example of, man, this is kind of a sleepy game against a team that no one's really thinking about, and the Raptors predictably win because they sort of should beat that team in that fashion. But Barnes does it in a way where you go, man, he was arguably their best player, and there's nowhere to go but up in that performance.
I think that floater range stuff we're talking about is so important to the trajectory, because, like, obviously, yes, you want him to be able to hit threes. He's not hitting as many mid-range jumpers as he was early in the season. Cool. But you know what the counter is going to be? The first counter teams are going to try with regularity against Scottie Barnes? It's the same thing they did against Pascal Siakam in the championship year once he became an established 20-point scorer. And we're going to put a big on you, and we're going to drop back into the paint. Yeah. And, okay, you're going to either have to finish against a lot of length, or you're going to have to pull up. And having that floater range package already, where from 5 to 12 feet, he's so comfortable. And, yeah, mechanically, it doesn't look all that great all the time. But that's the area of the floor where that's the avoid contact or protect the ball as you're getting your shot off area of the floor, right? It's going to be ugly sometimes, even like the most – like even the Etuan Moores of the league, who are floater range artists, like sometimes it's ugly to get those off without them getting blocked. So I think he's already got – he's already started his development in terms of, hey, teams are going to counter you by putting a 7-footer on you and guard you like a center. And the counter to that is, hey, you need a little bit of floater package. You need a little bit of short roll passing ability. And I think he's well on his way there.
Does the ugliness matter? Like, no. You mentioned just getting the job done. And we've seen players that don't have aesthetically pleasing shots that are efficient. But I wonder if the shooting percentage is a bit unsustainable, given that it might be mechanically imperfect.
I don't have a ton of concern about the field goal percentage, just because he's getting to the rim and to that kind of, again, the high paint area at a really, really high rate for a combo forward, right? Like, he's getting to the areas on the floor where your shooting percentage is just naturally going to be higher. I mean, you'll be streaky with those push shots a little bit, I think. But it's getting there that is generally the hardest challenge for a young player.
Yeah, so go ahead, Justin.
I was just going to say, but also who's there? Like, you mentioned that team might change who is defending Barnes. And if it is a bigger player, does something have to change in that regard? Or is that just something he's going to have to adjust to in terms of sharing the ball a little bit more in those instances?
Yeah, he'll adjust, and that's where some of the mid-range stuff comes in. That's where some of the, hey, you're going to have to use him as a screener and then ask him to pass out of those situations. There are always counters, and the honest answer is, if everything's clicking in this offense at the same time, you put a big on Scottie Barnes. Well, there's only so many guys on the floor for a defense, right? And you've got...
Oh, that's the point.
You don't want to run a ton of offense through OG, but OG can post up a smaller guy. Pascal Siakam loves when a smaller guy's guarding him. So you know, the best version of this team, you're going to force them into some difficult decisions with that, where, hey, if you're reshaping your big man usage to stop Scottie Barnes, you might be opening up something else. So there's always a back and forth with these kind of things.
That's the, I think... key to all of this is Scottie Barnes he's having a good rookie season. He deserves a lot of credit for the offense, but he's also in a really good spot, both on his team, but also on the timeline of the NBA. Like, you only get so many nights where you're playing the Cleveland Cavaliers, who have two bigs that can sit underneath the basket and block shots and gap you and take things away from you. How many nights do you end up where there's a team that has a traditional center, and they end up having to be on Precious Achiuwa or Kem Birch. They're sitting there, or they're sitting under the basket. They're trying to defend Pascal Siakam. And then Scottie Barnes ends up playing a wing player, where you go, why is this guy on Scottie Barnes? Oh, right, because not all NBA teams deploy multiple 6'9" guys. They deploy more traditional lineups. Guess what? There's not a lot of traditional centers out there anymore the way that there used to be. You don't end up with a lot of minutes on those kind of guys. And when you do, Scottie Barnes is a good enough ball handler where if you're outside on a player like him, he might draw a foul. He might blow by you. Same with Siakam. You know, like, Blake, you talk about Siakam loving when a smaller guy's on him. I would say that he loves it more when it's a bigger guy on him and he's, like, actually challenging and he has to go out on him. And he's saying, oh, now I'm going to blow by you. I'm going to go to the basket. I'm going to draw a foul. I'm going to get you off balance. What Barnes needs for that next step is to be able to hit a shot. because since January, he's under 30% from three. He's 29% on almost 100 threes since January, right? Like, it's a decent chunk, and we're finding out more and more that he frankly can't shoot the three yet. It's just, it's not there.
Not surprising.
No, not surprising, but also there were some signs early on of, oh, this guy's a better shooter than we think, and that's actually not true, okay? Like, we ended up with, oh, he can hit that shot wide open from time to time, but it still is kind of a miracle when it goes in for Scotty from three. Like, that's just it. And I bet you if you pull up those stats, Blake, of what those threes are, not a lot of them are contested. Teams aren't exactly going out to the three-point line challenging Scotty Barnes. We're talking about 30% over, what, 2.5 months now of not really being defended out of the three-point line.
You can go even further because this percentage on the year is only 30.6 on 144 three samples. So,
yeah.
Like, you can just go that far with it. But yes, yeah. And to answer your question,
he had a November though where he shot the three very well, and so that's why I kind of cherry picked it from January forward. But
to answer your question though, only 22 of his shots have been pull-ups, and almost like more than half have been classified as wide open,
right?
By NBA.com tracking data,
right? So I agree that and I think about it all the time when Scotty Barnes scores. Actually, is I go, why didn't they gap him and force him to come? But part of it is, though, is that the floater is really good, too. So he can come downhill at you and just kind of push that shot in over top before you have a chance to react, and he can end up drawing a foul. It just shows you how important ball handling is, right? Like how long it took Siakam to get the ball handling level of Scotty Barnes, how OG Anunoby has been in the NBA now for, what, 4 years, 5 years, and he still doesn't have it anywhere near where Scotty Barnes' ball handling is. It's just that it creates so much more for you to be able to get to your spots. That's how he's taking advantage of his size. And if you're optimistic about Barnes, you have to be so thrilled with the idea that that's already where he's at with his ability to handle the basketball at 6'9" with that build. So that's everything with this player, is that he can get to spots already. And not everybody who's a rookie, even Evan Mobley. I like Evan Mobley a lot. He's better than Scotty Barnes. He's unquestionably the rookie of the year. You know what Evan Mobley doesn't do better than Scotty Barnes? Get to his spots on offense. He's still a guy that primarily benefits from the work of other people and his shooting than he is someone that you can just kind of dump the ball off to in the post and say, yo, Mobley, create for yourself. He doesn't have that in his bag quite like Scotty Barnes. Barnes is an anomaly at that size to have that ability to dribble and do those things. It's like that's, you can see why the Raptors looked at him and said, hey, this is our number two guy in this draft.
Yeah, the only rookies scoring more than Scotty Barnes by volume are Franz Wagner, Jalen Green, and Cade Cunningham. Jalen Green and Cade Cunningham are, all three of those guys are in bad offensive environments. Cade and Jalen are shooting 40%.
Yeah.
And Scotty Barnes is at 49% on an easier diet of shots, for sure. But really, I'd say Franz Wagner is the only guy that you're like, okay, he's scoring a little bit more, and he's doing so more efficiently than Scotty Barnes, which is, I don't think even Coach David Thorpe, who was higher on Scotty Barnes than anyone, would have guessed, hey, he's the second most effective scorer as a rookie from this class. And obviously, that's not, project that out too far, but it's well beyond where our expectations were coming in.
Okay, so last thing on this Raptors game. We went a little long, so we'll touch on the baseball because the baseball was big yesterday too, so we did this.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say this quickly. I like Thad Young, and I'm really trying to get behind the Thad Young trade, but I just can't do it. I just cannot get there. I do not like the trade. It's not a good trade. And I'm not having an easy time understanding why the Raptors did it. If I'm a Spurs fan, I'm watching that game, I'm going, I can't believe we traded Thad Young for a first-round pick. I know it's a trade down. Everybody keeps saying it's a trade down, and I get that they didn't love the draft, but it just still doesn't sit well with me. Thad is not doing enough for this team that validates this to me. It doesn't change the ceiling of the team at all. He doesn't have a contract that rolls into next year. Yeah, you can sign him as a free agent, but you know what else you could have done? Sign him as a free agent next year. Like, I have a tough time believing there was going to be some kind of a unbelievably rich Thad Young market where the Raptors were going to be out of the conversation for this player. Like, I don't know. I like some of the stuff he does, but he's a good moment, bad moment guy still, right? Where he does some really nice things, but every once in a while he tries to overextend his offensive package and it looks really, really ugly. His defense is good, not great. And yeah, his fit with this Raptors team, I think, is still kind of questionable. There are a lot of moments where I go, hey, are they going to throw Thad in here? And it's not him. And I don't know. The fit is not obvious outside of his clear love for locker room guy. But I've said before, don't trade first round picks for locker room guys. I don't care if you don't like the draft. I just do not like the trade. I don't know if we're there yet where we can evaluate this. Probably not, because you need to see the play-in game, the playoffs, and whatever else happens, how they re-sign him. But as of this moment, where there was a check-in of playing the team you got him from, I just still sit here today going, I don't get it, and I don't like it.
I thought he looked okay last night. 7 points, 7 rebounds. Yeah.
He's okay.
And you start to see, this is the thing, is like, Thad Young is a good player, and I think he's more than just the leadership off the court. I think he's going to help some of these young forwards because they want to build a lot of Thad Young types. But in terms of the draft equity, like, it doesn't – there are a lot of redundancies with Thad Young's positional flexibility and his skill set. So I understand not liking the, hey, we're going to trade down half a round to get this guy and his bird rights. There's also the weird kind of – the weird situation where, like, Thad is – obviously going to help good players more than he helps developing players because he's a dot connector. On nights the team looks bad, this trade is going to look even worse. And on nights the team looks good, you're going to be like, okay, I get it a little bit. This is very much a we're going to have to try to evaluate what was the cost of moving down half a round and what is the benefit, and this is intangible, but what do the Raptors think the benefit is of Thad Young's leadership, Thad Young's bird rights, Thad Young's ability to contribute to a play-in game or a playoff series, which I do think is higher than it is in a regular season game. But all those things are a little tough to measure versus, hey, just play Precious a few more minutes or
few more minutes. Thank you. Is that they? It'd be one thing if they didn't have other 6'9" guys that are already off the bench that play the exact same role or that do occupy the exact same spaces, and that you already traded Kyle Lowry for in Precious Achiuwa, and that you have Chris Boucher, who comes off the bench, occupy those spaces and does those things that you need him to do. So, yeah, is Thad Young a smarter vet than some of those guys? Is he a better passer than those guys? Certainly. Is he a good locker room guy? I won't ever question that, because a million people say it. I just can't believe that a team like the Toronto Raptors, where they're at right now, was willing to risk not having a pick in next year's draft especially, which is still, again, on the table given all the parameters of what's going on, for less than half of a season of Thad Young. It's just I continue to look at it and ask myself, why, God, why? Why did this happen? How is this possible? How did Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster ever allow this pick to roll over not into two immediate seconds and have it be a first for Thad Young? I don't get it. I do not get how that could happen. He was playing, 15 minutes a night in San Antonio.
Well, he wasn't playing at all in San Antonio.
Right. That's what I mean, is he wasn't even playing for them. How did the value get so high on him?
Well, I really do think that, and you can disagree on this, obviously, but the Raptors really think that getting that high second back, that would be number 33 right now, like, that closes the gap between what you're feeling and what they're seeing. But
that's
yes, you can,
but that
you
might
you
not
disagree.
Happen.
What do you mean?
They might end up having the pick roll to next year, and it feels more and more like that is a realistic possibility. Like,
yeah, if they lose a play-in game,
that's it.
That's happening. And
they could end up playing a play-in game against Kevin Durant. This team is not a certainty to get out of that play-in game. And so that's all I'm saying, is the stipulation for it is, okay, I can get behind the part where it's a first-round pick and a trade down if you're locked into a playoff round, right? If the Raptors were locked into a playoff round, I would say, okay, I can stretch myself to see it. I would still not love it, by the way, but I would say, okay, I can stretch myself to see it. The fact that it can roll over in the next year is unbelievably perplexing to me. I don't know why the condition could not have been, hey, if this thing rolls over next year, it automatically becomes 2 second-round picks. The way that it does 2 years from now, why that didn't just get bumped up a season? And just like the disaster that this trade becomes if this is the scenario. You lose that play-in game and that rolls over next year. Disaster.
A disaster if they're not as good as they hope to be next year. Like yes, the number 15
pick. But even
pick
still,
in
the fact that you don't have that control.
Be
yeah, the fact yeah. that you don't have control over that pick is massive, Blake. It doesn't
right.
matter
I just
how
think
you shake
if,
it out.
If it slides into the 20s, won't care as much, but yeah.
Oof. Still, that's a stretch given how deep the NBA is. Yeah. Let's take a break. Let's talk about baseball in the A-list today, just because, you know, we can move some kickers around, but baseball has another horrible day where we did it again. We did it again, and I'm so tired of it, where the baseball world at large says, hey, you should get excited. And then we end up with the day finishing going, more games are canceled. Why'd you do this to us again? What? Just leave us alone until you make a deal. That's next on the A-List on the Fan Morning Show with JD, Justin, and Blake. Sports at 5-9 of the Fan.
Covering the Raptors in depth like no one else. The Raptor Show with Will Liu. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm not even going to play the A-list stinger today. I can't even do it. I can't bring myself to do it. Because there's nothing fun about this. And the A-list is supposed to at least have some measure of joy. Baseball's dead. You know, it's just gone. All right? The sport that I love, it's dead. There was this ad that ran yesterday that I saw for, I think it was for MLB The Show video game. And I saw it and I went, oh man, baseball is cool. I like baseball. It's a cool sport. Lots of cool guys play baseball. It's fun. It's fun to watch baseball. And then there was a little buzz. I was, you know, starting to text with my baseball friends about how, hey, look, this is getting pretty optimistic. People saying that since numbers are starting to get thrown around, like 65% a deal gets done today was one discussion in a group chat.
I was listening to this one morning radio show this week, and someone said it was like -350 odds.
Yeah,
to get done that day.
Listen, I'll punch you in the throat. Major League Baseball canceled more games over seemingly the international draft or creating an international draft. Max Scherzer tweeted this yesterday, by the way. I was in Florida. Thank you, Max. We never offered the international draft. We did discuss it, but MLB told us they were not going to offer anything for it. At that point, we informed all players and agreed to no draft. This is MLB muddying the waters and deflecting blame. Fans, please hang in there with us. I got to tell you, I'm very pro-labor here. I've been on this corner the entire time of the players are the guys that I root for in this scenario. They have been getting a raw deal, and they've been working backwards since 2016. Here's the thing, though, players. 2016 happened. It happened. You already did this. You're already in a kind of compromised situation. And I thought yesterday was a little bit of a win from the owners from the standpoint of they seemingly made meaningful concessions. They made meaningful concessions in the areas that matter. It looked to be a bit of a win for the players. And that's why everyone was so optimistic. Blake, we talked about this yesterday. Hey, what's this really about? Well, it's about the salary cap ceiling and the salary floor. And both those things improve for the players. Both of those things have gotten better for the players. And yeah, there's some hilarious tweets, like John Heyman did this thing where an owner texted him. He went, an owner told me they can't believe that they went this high. I go, yo, really? The owner that is negotiating on that behalf told you that they're in shock that they gave more money to the players? Hilarious that you're reporting this. But yeah, I did think a little bit, if the ball's moving this direction, enough smart people are saying this is making a lot of sense. International draft, we're going to talk to Jim Duquette later in the show, but I don't know how the hell this happened. I don't know how now the international draft is becoming a sticking point that's preventing me from getting multiple weeks of baseball season, and I don't think the players have done a good enough job. Max Scherzer, I'm sorry that you were in Florida, but you guys haven't done a good enough job explaining to fans or getting the message out there in a way that makes this palatable for people to stay behind you. Because to us, even to me, someone who's paying attention and wishes that he wasn't, I'm having a tough time understanding why you guys feel like this issue is worth so much money.
Okay, so there are a few things there. And the first one is, if the owners won the PR battle yesterday, it's just a matter of they have more lenses that are more focused on leaking information. Like, the players' pushback is that a lot of the stuff that's getting leaked isn't necessarily true. And then you have to have Max Scherzer go to Twitter to try to clarify something. The other thing that, and this has been reported places, but hasn't been a big talking point, is I would imagine there's some frustration on the side of the PA that removing draft pick compensation for qualifying offers was on the table most of this time and was not tied to the international draft until recently in the process. Now, it wasn't like a great, obviously the deal's not a deal until it's done, but I do get the sense that the players were operating under the idea that that was already done. So now that MLB is now trying to renegotiate the existence of qualifying offers and draft pick compensation based around an international draft is frustrating. Looking at it more short-sighted or even more cynically, you know, it is a little strange that they're close, and what's holding up the deal, it appears to be, is something that is taking care of future people. So people who are not currently members of the players union, right? So if you wanted to get really cynical, if you wanted to go full NBA where the executive committee is just max contract guys, you know, forget them kids. That they could do that. But I do think there's a component of long-term health of the game. You know, David Ortiz had some really nice perspective in an interview with Jeff Passan yesterday, where he kind of outlined that, like, hey, this could be a good thing, but you can't rush it because you're just going to carry over all of the issues with the current system into the new system if you don't do it carefully and thoughtfully. I don't know that that's something that's being expressed at the negotiating table versus,
I don't know what that means, though, Blake. Like, I don't know what that means as to why I'm missing 2 weeks of baseball.
Yeah, right. I mean,
that are rolling over to this. Like, that, well, even to me is, I'm going, what? I don't understand.
I know, and I'm trying to explain, and like, I think the players do feel at least a little bit more than the owners of a stewardship of the game and making sure the long-term health is there for future union stuff. But I also think the real thing is, Emma, the owners are asking for something else at the finish line. And we've joked about this, that, like, first it was bigger bases and then a 12-team playoff. And now there's something else in the way. So I think that's probably it at the root. That's what it is. Like, MLB's asking for something else with nothing in return for the players. But there's a lot to sort through there.
But, Blake, that's the problem I have. And Justin, I want you to jump in here. It's just that these guys keep going, we're the stewards of the game. We're protecting the game. We're going to make sure that the baseball doesn't change things. And baseball, but for more money. And they go, well, of course, for more money. You know, like, this isn't exactly the most principled stance that the players are taking anymore. And this is the issue that I have with everything. Is you go, Max Scherzer, you guys are not upset that they want to switch it to an international draft. And David Ortiz can go out there and say all he wants about how they're switching the issues over from one thing to the next, blah, 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 blah. Ultimately, it's just you didn't get the price you wanted for this thing. You're not getting the sticker price. You're not stewards of the game. Yeah, do you guys care? There's some guys that are probably annoyed by the bigger bases and the pitch clock and the shift and all these different things. Sure, I'm sure there are. But you guys have said you'll do whatever for money. You'll change anything for money.
But can you blame them? Like what if our boss?
Yes,
came right
I can blame them a little bit because they're making the season go away. Yeah, like, now JD, I'm starting to blame them.
We want you to do a fifth hour, but we're not going to pay you any more money for that.
No, but that's the thing. This isn't the fifth hour. This isn't a fundamental core issue. I understand when it's, hey, they're putting in a salary cap, and they're calling it a different thing, and we want to have it higher because we need to get paid more, and we're already getting completely screwed because baseball is making money hand over fist, and they don't want to share it with us properly. And I go, that's great. Get your money. But the idea that these guys are using every little part of the game that I hold near and dear and saying, no, that's not worth the price of this, is like, no, 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 no. That's not how this works. You got to either hold firm on certain things and say they're non-negotiable and you got to move off of them, or figure it out and get a baseball season done already. Compromise on some areas. And it kind of feels like this is the one where the players lost me a little bit. And I'm still pro player. I'm not saying that all of a sudden I'm going, oh, the owners have done a great job. And Blake, you're right. They've done a better job of communicating their message. But when these things happen, the message is king. Who controls the message controls the people. And that's what's going on right now, is that the players are doing a craptastic job at explaining why the international draft should be worth a ton of money to them and that it should change the tilt the negotiating table. Get out of here. Give us the draft. Stop putting a price on everything.
I'm 100% with you, JD. I think they felt slighted, and that's probably the reason why there isn't a deal. Do you think they care about them kids, the guys that are set to lose $20 million every day? I don't buy it. There's no chance.
I know, that's what I mean. And yeah, this is what's now starting to irk me, is that the players are going back into the sanctity of the game argument.
There's no
way that Kevin Pillar was talking about feeding his family in that one. Now we're going back here, is that the longer you draw out these negotiations, the more susceptible the players become to starting to talk about these things where they purport themselves to be champions of baseball, when in reality they're like, yeah, sure, we'll change anything. Move the fence, take the fences away, do whatever. We'll change this to wiffle ball. Just give us our money, you know? We don't care.
They care about the money that they haven't started losing yet. Yes, there have been a couple canceled series, a couple more now, but it hasn't started happening yet. And when that starts really happening, you think they're going to care? No, they're not going to care about the international draft. And the thing that bothered me the most about yesterday is that Ken Rosenthal basically wrote the piece I was looking for, trying to figure out why it is that the international draft is the sticking point. And I think Blake nailed it. It's just what was thrown in. But the economic issues, according to Rosenthal, are, quote, practically agreed upon. If that's like, that is what this is all about. It's about the economic issues. And if it is practically agreed upon and they don't play because of an international draft, who is going to sympathize with the players who are the ones that are basically saying, no, we cannot have that implemented. That is the reason why we don't have a deal. I get that's owner spin. I guess that's what they want us to know. But if the economic issues are practically agreed upon, we should be playing baseball as soon as possible here.
I'm just more a man of the people, more a man of the labor, I suppose. No, there's
explain
validity
then.
I already did.
No, you said they're rolling over the issues from one year to the next. That's a PR jargon. That's
no,
like,
it's not.
We need more synergy.
When David Ortiz comes out and says, I'm worried about the treatment of 12-year-old Dominican kids because baseball takes advantage of them and the system is so corrupt. Sure, it's not a part of the current union. But when a player with a voice as loud in the Dominican population of MLB players as David Ortiz speaks up and says that stuff, it's at least worth listening to so you understand that perspective. I'm not saying that, hey, that means there's absolutely no price tag. It's a complete moral failure if this passes through. There's obviously a price tag.
But this is the problem, Blake. You can't go, hey, it's about these 12-year-old kids that they'll be corrupted and we need to look out for the 12-year-old kids. And then Max Scherzer goes, but yeah, but it's because they didn't offer us any money to screw over those 12-year-old kids. All right? And someone come and showing up with a big bag of money,
everything
we'd be throwing those kids into the ocean.
Like, everything is a negotiation. And like, look, don't forget, too, that the last two or three labor disputes, the owners absolutely steamrolled the players with tactics exactly like this of like, okay, we've agreed on the certain things. And if you don't take this, what's on the table now, we're going to lock you out. You won't make money. We'll put the PR spin on. And the players' union can't have another big loss like that because the more you do it, the less leverage you have next time around.
For sure.
And these are only 5-year CBAs that we're talking about.
Yep.
They're not long-term labor pieces.
The dumbest thing is people who are going, just sign this deal and worry about the next CBA. Because it's going, no, that's not what
happens. All the guys who are on the executive committee who won't be in baseball by the time the next CBA comes around, what?
My contention is that you cannot, like, you got to stop using the this is for the kids argument. I'm sorry. It doesn't,
I don't feel like that was a crutch of my argument. I feel like it was one thing that the players are, at least the Dominican population of players, are trying to bring attention to. And yes, saying, hey, we should slow this down and it shouldn't come until 2024 for this reason and that. And as part of that, they're like, also,
money.
What do we get back? What do we get back? Drop
the
draft pick compensation for the qualifying offer.
We got a break. We got a break. We're so late.